Hello and welcome back to the TFT podcast. I'm Ryan. That's Matt. Matt, you can't buy me podcasts, but you can buy me this one. Because today we are celebrating the 50th anniversary of the British invasion, of the Beatles' historic appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show. Exactly. Yeah, actually, can we edit in just like screaming, high-pitched screaming?
I'll provide it while you talk. I'll provide it throughout the whole podcast so that no one will be, you know, left out.
That's right. So today will be forever marked as the beginning of Sheely Mania. So we're here to talk about the Beatles. We're going to talk about their performance on the Ed Sullivan Show, as well as the two albums that bookended that. The British release, With the Beatles, and we may touch a little bit on the recollection and repackaging of that in America the British is with the Beatles, and Meet the Beatles is the American one, and then also the soundtrack album for the film A Hard Day's Night that was released later in 1964. Matt, maybe there's a lot of places to get into it with the Beatles, but I think, you know, in some ways, I'm going to go back, since we're out of our historical comfort zone and our geographical comfort zone, I think I have to, you know, ask just a very simple question. These guys, with their haircuts and their guitars, are they for real?
So, to a certain extent, I have to admit, I don't totally know. Because I am missing the Beatles gene, or maybe it's that my parents were missing the Beatles gene, right? Like, let me hijack this podcast.
You are an Anglophile too, right? Yeah,
let me hijack this podcast to tell you a little bit about my family. My dad is a banjo player, a clawhammer style banjo player. So not even the cool bluegrass banjo is within banjo playing. It is a minor subculture of banjo playing, is the style of banjo picking that my father plays. And he is in fact an award-winning banjo player in folk music competitions here in Topanga Canyon in Los Angeles, where the hippies live, and loves traditional American music, just loves it, and then some sort of offshoots of that, like Texas swing with like Bob Wills and his Texas Playboys and things like this. My mother listens to commercial country music, and I keep threatening that they're going to make her like give back her PhD, though that's probably very insulting to the many highly educated people out there who, you know, love what Nashville puts out. But I've never been into it. And so my dad, slightly on the more indie side, and my mom slightly on the more commercial side, never listened to the Beatles. And I have a feeling that of our generation, it's our parents' generation who generally introduced us to the Beatles, even if we took it and run with it. I don't know if that holds true for you, but it was, you know, it was their generation's music, right? And they were, our parents' generation were teenagers in the 60s and were just at the prime time for the British invasion. So
it's interesting. So my parents were actually, I think biography is actually a decent way to get into this, or family history. So my parents are actually quite a bit younger than yours, and I think actually were a bit too young for Beatlemania. So my parents were 7 years old in 1964, and so we're just a little bit outside of the core core demographic in which the floppy haired pheromones had their highest level of effect, right? So that they're they were so kind of pre-tween, even before tweens existed. And so they were not as aware of that. I think that later in the, you know, when my dad was in, you know, in high school in the 70s, got into the later Beatles, right? So that, you know, the Beatles had a, you know, a career that, that really, you know, at least the major kind of superstardom started in 1964 and carried through to the band's dissolution in the late 1960s. But the latter half of that, so albums like The White Album and Let It Be and Abbey Road are a bridge into kind of the, you know, classic rock of the 70s, and that was very much my dad's scene, and he played bass in a rock band. I know one of the vinyl LPs that was around our house as a kid was a one of two sets of Beatles kind of greatest hits CDs that were put out, I believe, in the 70s. And these are known, in my mind, I was going to say to fans, but I don't know if this is true. But to me, these are known as the Red Collection and the Red Albums and the Blue Albums, right? So the Blue Albums collect 1967 to 1970, and so have the more hirsute Beatles with all their funny facial hair and long hair and you know, the John Lennon glasses, and the Red Albums are the earlier iteration that kind of covers the period that we're looking at. So it's like 1963 to 1967. So the earliest singles and first studio albums up through Revolver. So everything before Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, which is kind of the transitional point for the Beatles. But so my family had the Beatles 67 to 70, so the Blue Album in the house, but I never really was into it. And for a long time, you know, there's a period where, you know, in youth, one kind of likes the same stuff as one's parents. And then there's a period in adolescence or early pre-adolescence where one starts, you know, doing the opposite. And actually for me, liking the Beatles actually started not really having too much to do with my parents, but was actually in middle school in the mid-90s when when there was a thing called the Beatles Anthology Series.
Yep.
Came out. And so this was a documentary TV series and a three-volume set of albums that really like looked at the history of the Beatles collected a lot of B-sides and rare tracks and live tracks from throughout their career, and these were released in like 1995 and 1996, that was around the time when I was in middle school in seventh and eighth grade, and I saw one of these documentaries and was hooked, because I think that you know, and at that time what I liked was alternative rock, and you know, liked Nirvana, and I liked Green Day, and I liked everything that was on MTV in the alternative category, and I was totally surprised about how much the Beatles rocked, and specifically, you know, started from the late Beatles gradually moved expansively through every edge of their catalog. So then at that time, I then, you know, the Blue Album lying around was a resource, but in some ways it was much more of a self-directed, you know, in my mind, self-directed thing that was obviously planted there by a promotional effort by, you know, a record company, and really went through. But I actually, you know, really for a huge, grade up through early high school, you know, I definitely would have told you that the Beatles were my favorite band, and I, you know, had copies of all of the albums. Had preferences, even, you know, for the British versions of the albums rather than American versions of track listings that were released. And also read as many of the Beatles books and secondary literature as I can. So it's one of these actually first pop culture things that I was actually really, really obsessed with.
And also, I don't know, you do research professionally now in scholarship, right? And like seems to presage that as a sort of career choice and a very sort of egocentric, undertaking profession for you, right?
Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, that was one of the first things, I do engage with pop culture in a very similar way. And as I'm thinking about it, you know, in some ways, the Beatles were one of the first things that I actually explored in that way, in part because there was, you know, because there is, you know, was at the time and is now even more so a huge secondary literature on the Beatles. And the book that I ended up buying and really reading obsessively is a book called Tell Me Why, The Beatles Album by Album, Song by Song, The 60s and After by Tim Riley. And we'll put a link in the show notes to the current edition of that. I read an earlier edition that had a much uglier cover than the current edition. But this goes, you know, it's exactly what it says in the title, and is a detailed both musical and kind of sociocultural analysis of – I mean, it's a fascinating book because it kind of works at all of the different levels of analysis at once, so that in a given chapter – it might first introduce some of the broad macro trends that are going on historically, what's happening in the 1960s, what's happening in popular music. It might zoom down in what's happening in the collectivity of the Beatles and their kind of assorted network of managers and producers and their individual lives. And then it zooms into the album, some details about the recording of the album, and then it zooms even further to analyses of every song. And so actually, you know, again, describing this, in addition to this kind of obsessive detail and way of kind of cataloging and cross-referencing that is part of academic research, I think also, you know, some of these hallmarks of, you know, of how one works and what one does, I think, again, are very both important to my formation as an overthinker and as an academic, right? If a lot of what this book's doing is kind of, you know, sociological analysis or kind of pop sociological and pop historical, there's a lot there. So there's a combination of the Beatles work and the kind of Beatles scholarship that I think was very important to me. And it was kind of, you know, if not genetic, was definitely discovered. But you know, maybe I had some kind of a predisposition.
Yeah. So that's interesting, but it happened. You see, you might be sort of supporting the point that I had intended to make, which is that I did not get, they didn't get their hooks into me young. You know mm-hmm. what I mean?
Yeah.
And I have discovered, you know, just in life experience, that there are people for whom the Beatles is an almost and affinity for the Beatles is an almost like precognitive thing, you know, that they're just so viscerally sort of into the Beatles, and they have, you know, a huge knowledge of the songs just sort of experientially from listening to them over and over and over again. And though I think that you can't be not familiar with the Beatles and be in our culture the same way you can't be like not familiar with Christianity and be in our culture, you know, though
the
Beatles are bigger.
As John Lennon famously said, they were bigger than Jesus. Right?
I mean, honestly, discursively, that may be the case. But
they had to kill. They had to kill the new sheriff in town. That sheriff's name was Jesus.
I don't have the same kind of familiarity with it, or the same kind of like investment of my own tastes and character and personality. As I have seen a lot of people have, and like later in life when I sort of started going methodically through the history of rock and roll music and sort of looking at it and kind of figuring out gaps in my listening and what I wanted to listen to, I discovered I liked the Stones a lot better just from my contemporary, just from my contemporary point of view.
I mean, interestingly, I may have, in the last 5 to 10 years, I've probably listened to the Stones more than I've listened to the Beatles. And, you know, in some ways, the Beatles are more like, I don't know what it is. I definitely have a strong positive valence when a Beatles song comes on. I'm excited about it. I often know the words. And, you know, obviously when prompted, there's a lot of things I may spew out about Beatles songs, but it's not that, like, I don't, they're not on a go-to, you know, listening list for me. And actually I don't even have, digital copies. You know, it's actually part of why I haven't listened to the Beatles recently is that their catalog is not available for streaming. They're kind of notoriously tight with their publishing, and so, you know, this collection of, you know, dubbed cassettes or burned CDs that I had throughout my adolescence, largely there's been tremendous attrition throughout, you know, the last, you know, both specifically, you know, the kind of decade plus of post-collegiate moves that we kind of talked about in a few episodes ago in our moving house episode, that in fact a lot of that Beatles detritus ceased to form the actual, like, physical stuff of Beatles stuff does not really necessarily form the physical infrastructure of identity, even if there's a kind of deeper cognitive infrastructure of which the Beatles are there, right? And that's kind of, again, like you say, almost pre cognitive. It's I mean, in some ways it's like a language that I speak. You know, there's a, you know, in some ways there's the, and I feel like part of that is, you know, experiencing the Beatles at the album level, you know, going, again, as the Tim Riley book says, album by album, song by song. I guess so, Matt, so, you know, so for you, I mean, you know, like, so as we said, we're kind of setting the stage of how we're approaching this. And so for me, I think this is interesting because this is my first time listening to both of these albums, you know, as kind of after kind of both starting the, I mean, I don't know if I've actually listened to either of these albums since we started overthinking it. So in the last 6 years or so, and certainly it's my first, you know, with this kind of research, the current TFT research project in mind, and you're kind of approaching both of these, you know, relatively fresh. I mean, I think some of the and so I guess one question I have for you to kind of, you know, to try a different research question, is, you know, what was most surprising to you about listening to these two albums, to With the Beatles and Hard Day's Night?
I think the surprising thing, and maybe I was primed to think this because we had, you know, chatted about them before, but the surprising thing to me was actually because they're so close in time, the difference between the two albums, just the very different feel I get from Meet the Beatles or With the Beatles and what's the first one? Hard Day's Night. And right, and the idea that, like, something fundamental had happened, and I don't know the history, so I don't know what it was, but I can describe the effects of it, right? That Hard Day's Night is a lot more just sort of sonically focused. The vocal harmony is used in a different way, right? It's sort of moved into a from, like, doo-wop background vocals into a sort of kind of close harmony with the melody, and especially in, like, in Hard Day's Night, a couple of those, like, little chromatic runs that are in there really serves to highlight them. The songwriting seems a lot more specific and tighter to me in the album of originals rather than in the album of covers of famous songs, which were, you know, supposedly famous because they were so well constructed, right? So, right, you know, such surefire hits, right? As songs, I mean, they seem sort of loose and kind of anodyne compared with the much better compared with the much better lyric writing. I'll say this, though, about with the Beatles. I think they have a great sound. It's a lot looser. It's a lot less tight and focused than on Hard Day's Night, to my ear anyway, without a huge amount of familiarity with it. But I am, like, really impressed at with that sort of lineup, that, you know, guitar, you know, lead, rhythm, bass, drums lineup, how many sounds and how many feels and moods they really get out of that. And it sort of, when you talk about sort of more, the more commercial side of pop music today or forever, right, I guess, right, and how homogenous it is, there's really no excuse for that, right? Because here's the Beatles doing, you know, a pop record of covers, right?
Well, it's half covers, right? I think it's worth noting.
Yeah.
So that there is about, of the 14 tracks on With the Beatles, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So fully half are covers.
Okay.
And half are originals.
That's a lot. I mean, I don't know. That's a lot. For my expectations of the kind of album rock format, which the Beatles inaugurated, right? Like half covers strikes me as being a lot. So it's, you know, though, okay, maybe I was overstating their predominance. They are sort of dominant, right? Like,
yeah.
So even given that, right? Like, even given the sort of that they didn't originate a lot of the material, they managed to find a huge amount of variety in it, from from what we think of as like 16th note rock grooves today to like country two-step to something that sounds to me kind of like Latin influence.
Yeah, or exactly. There's definitely a few claves in there.
Yeah. And sort of rhythmically, that sort of 16th note, Begin, you know, tempo a la Begin or something like that.
Originating the album oriented rock. And I think that, you know, it's worth noting that and this is mentioned in some of the we'll link. There's been a ton of think pieces on the Beatles recently because of the proximity to this anniversary, and one mentions that, you know, at the, you know, before the Beatles, that really 45s, right, the singles were the domain of teenagers, and teenagers bought 45s because they were cheap. They focused on, you know, the pop songs, the songs that were on the radio, and full-length albums, you know, 33 RPM albums, the big ones, were largely bought by adults. And so what was, you know, popular there, in some ways the technology was used in part to showcase things like classical music performances, soundtracks of Broadway musicals, and like sort of collections of songs by singers, right? That and so, I mean, I think it would be interesting to see. So again, relative to other Beatles albums or, you know, any album that we see today, With the Beatles has a tremendously high proportion of covers. But I think that and I think what is really important in this transition is that, you know, that their first album, Please Please Me, had a similarly high number of covers, but then by A Hard Day's Night, you know, one album later and kind of released less than a year after With the Beatles was released, they've written all of their own songs, and so I think that there is, So I think though that that you're absolutely right that there's even at the point of With the Beatles, a tremendous amount of artistry in interpretation, right, and just even in the choice. You know, I think that there's like a lot of interesting, you know, cutting across, there's a lot of digging into, you know, rock and, you know, kind of a older era of rock and roll of the 1950s of Motown and soul, you know, and of kind of like slightly like more obscure songs like "Devil in Her Heart." You know, there's actually in some ways like how to understand with the Beatles is actually. You know, from my understanding, I actually don't know a lot about what else was popular in the early 60s and when the Beatles got popular. But my sense if any of you listeners are more knowledgeable about this, about the music of the late 50s and early 60s, my sense is that rock and roll was actually not that cool anymore. And kind of as, you know, certainly at the level of albums, but even at the level of singles to a certain extent that, you know, there had that what was popular, was a bit different than this guitar driven, rock. And so, you know, even if in one's mind, as one kind of talks about history of rock and roll, one starts at Chuck Berry if you think about like Chuck Berry and Elvis and, kind of the first era of rock and roll. And then you think about a linear progression to the Beatles in terms of what was popular, that's actually not necessarily the case. And that the Beatles, you know, what I kind of see and was thinking about in reading some of the secondary literature and listening to the albums is that part of what the Beatles are doing at the point of with the Beatles is similar to, you know, any of the various, you know, decade revivals that happen in contemporary indie rock, right? So that these, you know, a revival of, you know, if there were, and we haven't talked a lot about bands that have revived, you know, the new wave music, but there's, you know, every decade in indie rock, there's, you know, right now or in the last 5 years, there have been a lot of bands that have actually been revisiting the sounds of the 90s, that have been revisiting grunge or revisiting earlier elements of kind of, you know, college radio rock of the late 80s and early 90s. There were earlier waves of reviving the 1980s, you know, in bands and in post-punk revival. And we've talked about this a little bit in previous iterations of previous episodes of TFT. And so my sense is that part of what the Beatles were doing is kind of that right? They are this rock that's happening, and that, you know, they kind of were obsessed with these influences. Liverpool, and both, you know, at the level, once it's kind of reaching this this first record, they're both, you know, in fact, even though half an album of covers seems rather high for a proportion of covers for our tastes, actually kind of shocking for a pop band of the time. And so what you sort of see happening is and, you know, without knowing, other than kind of knowing the famous songs like Please Mr. Postman or Money or Roll Over Beethoven, that they, you know, largely a lot of the other covers really blend in with the originals and stand well side by side, in part due to the dynamism of both the vocal performances and of the instrumental performances.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's right. I was putting a thought together, which was that, like, I think it's yeah, the social context is important. I think the technological context, which you also talked about, and the sort of advent of the LP, is also important, and the advent of like the electric guitar, probably as a which is something that's touched on in one of the articles that we'll leave show notes to in the it's actually excerpts from a book that we'll leave links to in the show notes. The advent of the electric guitar. But I hadn't put together a parallel that now occurs to me, until you just said all that, which was that it sort of reminds me of the the situation in pop music at the turn of the millennium, right? With, you know, people like Britney Spears, who we talked about last week, and a sort of return to a kind of bubblegum pop akin to Brill Building pop that, you know, has its charms, right? That kind of has its place, but doesn't have anything like the as you say, dynamism that the Beatles brought to it, or that the you know, I don't know what happened in music in the early 2000s, right? Brought to it, and the sort of indie revival that to me is referenced to kind of the singer songwriters of the 1970s a little bit, and to you know, and to maybe grunge music of the 1990s also, and
well,
some other things.
Well, and actually one of the sounds that one actually is seeing now, I mean, it's so interesting how kind of there is this, you know, we talked about this a little bit. We've talked about this throughout, you know, throughout our music, you know, year of, or you know, throughout the last few weeks of TFT, last few months really. But especially last week, we kind of talked about, you know, what comes first, the indie or the pop, and is indie pop an injection of indie into music that is pop, that is kind of primarily produced for a commercial benefit, or is pop a removal or an extraction of independence? I think that you know, last week I postulated that it was, you know, that indie pop is an injection of indie into a popular style, and I do think that, you know, in some ways, another, as in terms of another you know, example, a contemporary example of something, what actually one of the frontiers on which this is happening in current indie music, and in which it's kind of very much eating its own tail, is that in the last two or three years, one of the sonic touchstones in a lot of independent music has actually been the R&B of the early of the late 80s and early 90s, of, you know, singers like Mariah Carey, artists like TLC, and that this has been used by artists like Grimes. I mean, it's even there to an extent in some of the vocal styles and harmonies in Lorde. You know,
I thought you were going to go to Ariana Grande. And
but it's really interesting, right? So this is how quickly it's cycling, right? So that you have it happening at the level, you know, it's also artists like How to Dress Well that we haven't talked about. You know, yet on the podcast, that, you know, that even artists like the Weeknd, and then, you know, at the level of Lorde, Ariana Grande, you know, and to an extent Haim, you know, is getting incorporated to groups that are more and more popular, have more and more commercial success, right? So these, and, you know, again, and the Beyonce album. So these things, the Ouroboros is eating itself, you know, at a more and more rapid pace.
Well, once the Ouroboros goes around once, right, it's chomping down on two or three layers of itself at any given time.
right.
And that's the stage we're at.
Yeah, exactly. So, and I think that this is cool in some ways, why I think it's interesting to reach back to the Beatles, and we, you know, we may think about reaching further back, is that this is an important moment in that happening, and it's unclear, we, you know, we haven't gone far back, you know, to know, is this the first instance of the Ouroboros catching its tail in its mouth and seeing, you know, how itself tastes, or are there, you know, have there been a few, are, by the time the Beatles come around, are there a few other iterations? And I think that's something to just kind of keep an eye on, because, you know, I think that, you know, part of what you see in the, you know, the narrative of the, you know, the, of, you know, at least what had to happen for, you know, the invasion to happen, for, you know, the Beatles, for Beatlemania to spark, which is that, you know, these, a few songs, being, released. And I think, you know, some of the major ones, that preceded the 1964 arrival were She Loves You and I Want to Hold Your Hand, if I'm not mistaken. And I think those were also featured on at least I Want to Hold Your Hand and was actually featured on the American version of with the Beatles, which was released as Meet the Beatles. That, you know, this kind of part of what sparked that was a really, you know, concerted effort by the Beatles manager, Brian Epstein, to get them a record deal. And that this was, you know, rather than the Beatles being, you know, so it's an interesting thing, right? Like, they certainly, you know, in a discourse that didn't exist back then, you know, existed, you know, relatively independently, right? They played the, you know, the club rock circuits, again, as I said before, of Liverpool and Hamburg, and, you know, playing a mix of cover, you know, playing rock music that was, you know, popular in those cities and in those particular scenes. But they, you know, were neither assembled nor by a record label, nor were they really sought after. That you know, Epstein had to really pull many favors and you know, engage in a tremendous amount of in favor trading to get the first singles pressed, and to bring on board George Martin, who ended up being the producer that produced most of the singles and albums for the Beatles throughout their career up until very, very kind of close to the end. And so I think that there is this interesting element of, you know, on the one hand, while the Beatles were huge, right? And this, you know, the Ed Sullivan, something like 75 million people in America, and, you know, the population of the country at that time was what, like,
on the order of 200 million,
right? Exactly. So, I mean, you know, the equivalent is, you know, essentially this is a Super Bowl level of viewership in terms of proportionally, right? And so this was something that was massively popular. But, you know, as we talked about with Britney Spears, there's an element of contingency too as well. So I guess, I mean, here's an interesting thing, right? So maybe we can pivot a little bit of, you know, we, at the top of the show, we talked about the, you know, the screaming of the teenagers, right? And a huge element of Beatlemania, and we'll, you know, we'll link the audio of the, you know, February 9th, 1964, Ed Sullivan performance. And you can hear throughout it, you can hear the shrieking, right? And so that the, you know, frantic, you know, fandom and obsession and mania of, you know, teenagers and particularly, you know, teenage girls, was a huge element of what drove, Beatlemania. And so I think that, you know, I guess as you listened, what in the, you know, what does the actual content of the songs and the kind of lyrical content of songs on either album, you know, how does this relate with teenagehood and kind of the formation of teenagehood, right? In terms of the kind of themes that we're talking about, you know, either we talked about with Britney Spears last week, or kind of some of the our older hobby horses. What is going on with the Beatles and the teenagers?
And these, right, and these kids today.
TST, these screaming teenagers.
Well, they, I want to, I want to do a couple of things. One is I want to avoid the great man theory of history a little bit, and you know, I don't know, talk about economics and social trends. But I want to read you a poem, and the poem is called Annus Mirabilis. It's by Philip Larkin, the British poet. You have to know he's British because one rhyme relies on a British pronunciation. It's called Annus Mirabilis, and it goes like this. In fact, all it really needs to read is the first two stanzas. Sexual intercourse began in 1963, which was rather late for me. between the end of the Chatterley Band and the Beatles' first LP. Up to then, there'd only been, and you have to understand that bean is pronounced as the British would, up to then, there'd only been a sort of bargaining, a wrangle for the ring, a shame that started at 16 and spread to everything. I think that this was a society that was waiting for the Beatles, right? Where there was a Beatles size opening to be filled, right?
Which to sell a yellow submarine.
so long and so hard and so full of semen, strumming their guitars. If the Beatles had not come along, it would have been necessary to invent them, right? And in a way, they did. I mean, they did invent them. Unless do you want to try to make the claim that there is something intrinsically in those songs, and especially in the album "I Want to Hold Your Hand," that that was missing from. I don't think we have enough of a wide historical view to say that it was missing from all other things at the time. I think that it's a case of there was a generation sort of looking to differentiate itself, and there were a bunch of economic and social movements having to do with post-war economic expansion, having to do with the advent of the pill, right, in a sense of like individuality and liberation that was ascendant. In this late part of the 50s, because I think of the 50s as lasting until the Beatles appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show, and maybe even longer, yeah. Right? And not becoming the 60s until the 67 or something like that. But they needed something.
I think so. There's an interesting thesis here, right? And I've maybe this has been made before, but essentially what you're saying. I mean, there's a few different ways to read this, but one is that in fact. That people assume that there is a causal relationship between the Beatles and Beatlemania. But that, in fact, there was a latent mania that, in fact, that just attached itself to the Beatles, right? And so that's like the least – the thing that – so the version that ascribes the least amount of kind of causal force to the Beatles is that there was a – So the least Beatles-centric interpretation is that there was a mania that happened to be starting, in February of 1963, and the Beatles showed up and it engulfed them.
It needs something to
or it needed a spark
in the way that when you're 13 or 14 or something, and you suddenly puberty hits, right? Like you're gonna have a crush on someone, what I mean? And it almost doesn't matter who. And a lot of these things, I don't know. I spent a semester teaching middle school and they never shut up very often about who they have crushes on, or it's very transparent to read in their behavior. And much of it is extraordinarily stupid and makes no sense, but it almost doesn't matter, right? Because you need an object for that energy, right?
Let me tell you something really interesting about, so I think that's true. And I think that, there's not a lot necessarily to be gained in talking about what about these songs, caused Beatlemania. But I think that I think that in some ways what's more interesting, where there may be some traction, is understanding the kind of depth, breadth, and longevity of Beatlemania and its offshoots, right? That, that Beatlemania, at some point imperceptibly also became, tied up with the hippie movement and with the broader youth culture movements of the later 1960s. And I think that there is some uniqueness there. And regardless, that the kind of, again, the intensity and there's a kind of, well, apart from discussing the, what caused the, the popularity of the Beatles and the frenzy that incited, I think there are some interesting elements, and that ensure that the Beatles were more than a fad. And I think that – so I think you're right that in some ways the object of the – you know, that there is a kind of a latent crush in search of a target. I think what's interesting about the Beatles by you know, by design, that kind of feeds that and is unique and separates them from, you know, kind of counterfactual targets of this, is that is two things, right? So one are four distinct Beatles who, you know, both have distinct personalities and who, you know, for whom this was. And then as the kind of brand management of the Beatles developed, you know, it developed even more, right? So that, you know, John Lennon was the kind of was boy. Paul McCartney was the sweet romantic. George Harrison is kind of the quiet, stoic, mysterious one. Right. And this is a kind of archetype that you see, you know, in a lot of the later boy bands of the 90s or in One Direction today. It'd be interesting to see how much, you know, the extent to which there were prior models of that kind of identity. Right. So there's kind of in this brand, in the from a brand perspective, there was a Beatle for everyone. Right. So if in other types of potential, you know, counterfactual Beatles, you know, if you kind of imagine a counterfactual, you know, big band, you know, making it and kind of, you know, if there is a just, a tinderbox of hormones, and we're thinking about counterfactual matches to be thrown into that, that in some ways I would argue that, you know, that what the Beatles were was this kind of, you know, a quad match with four distinct heads and kind of, I don't know, like reserves of gasoline that kind of both struck broader, more sides of the tinderbox and then kept fueling it a little more. And so I think that – so there's this – the distinct personalities, and then these were actually tied to – distinct performance and songwriting, right? That I think a really unique thing about the Beatles, and again, I would love to, you know, in our future research, see if this is, you know, truly path-breaking or if there is some precedent. But, you know, it was the Beatles decided pretty early on, at the core kind of songwriting partnership was between Lennon and McCartney, and all of their publishing, regardless of who is like the lead singer and or the lead songwriter, they shared publishing, right? They shared Lennon and McCartney. But then beyond that, it was also decided that everyone would sing, right? And early on, it was, you know, it was much later till Ringo was writing too many songs, and he, you know, had at most one or two songs per album, and I think has none on Hard Day's Night, and I think that, you know, Harrison, similar early on, only, you know, sings you know, one on Hard Day's Night, only sings one or two on With the Beatles. But that even so, that you have, you know, linked to these like distinct kind of personas or brand identities, actual distinct performance styles. And you see this, I think, especially and beyond performance styles, actual songwriting modes. And, you know, that in Lennon's songs, and you see this both in With the Beatles and Hard Day's Nights, you see this, like, you know, in some ways he's kind of the proto kind of pickup artist, right? There's a lot of negging, not a lot of negging and manipulation going on in Lennon's songs. Uh-huh. Of like, you know, all I have to do is call you and you'll be running home, and you know, the possessiveness of you can't do that. Uh-huh. And the kind of passive aggression of I'll cry instead. Like, John Lennon is a real douchebag.
he's one of those real sort of manipulative boyfriends, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really there. I mean, it's And then it's really interesting, right? And then what's really fascinating, though, is that there's a basically a like there's basically a like good cop bad cop of like teenage lust, right? So Lennon's the bad cop, and then McCartney's the good cop, right? You know, McCartney, you know, comes in with "You Can't Buy Me Love" and giving you all my loving, and you know, even the covers that you know McCartney sings are much more of the "You Really Got a Hold on Me." No, I guess that one is Lennon, but "Till There Was You," right, is much more sweet. And so you really do see this, you know, the good cop, bad cop act. And I think that, you know, on their own, each is really compelling. And, you know, even at this early stage in their career, there's, you know, a lot of compelling kind of songwriting, but more it's the combination, right? You know, what it's doing, both in terms of, you know, being able to sustain the album, but then kind of feed and sustain the kind of latent thing that's out there, is something that's kind of unique about the Beatles. And again, they just happened to be, I think that it didn't cause the Beatlemania, but it definitely fueled the endogenous dynamics of Beatlemania.
Sure. It was available to it, right? It was available as an object of what I suppose kind of projection and fantasy on the part of the fans.
Right, exactly. Well, and then beyond that, like some of the actual, you know, distinct songwriting voices, it both did get noticed. It both supported the projection and, like, you know, increased, you know, it actually, you know, also had something to do with, you know, the at least artistic merit of the songs. I mean, even just the, you know, distinct voices that you get at the micro level of a song, of a Hard Day's Night, of the trading off of the you know, verses and choruses with the bridges, right? That if I'm not mistaken, that you get Lennon for the, you know, "It's been a hard day's night, I've been working like a dog," and then you get McCartney in the "When I'm Home, everything is going to be right," or so that you have whether at the level of song sequencing or within songs, a lot of variation and tension that's provided, so that, you know, in addition to you know, enabling this projection and marketing, there is like an interesting play with, you know, at the level of kind of vocal and persona and actual songwriting, the actual substance of the music and the lyrics and the kind of more external stuff is all converges to kind of create tension and release. And there's kind of tension and release throughout this that's done quite artfully and is managed, you know, even then as they become even better songwriters and better musicians throughout the 60s, you know, grows more and more.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that there is something, right? So even if it's not, you know, necessarily a great man theory of history, I think that there is, you know, argue that there is a lot of kind of, you know, that's artistically and musically really interesting here. And that doesn't explain why this happened and why the Beatles rather than anyone else, but it does.
And I didn't mean to. I didn't mean to shit on the Beatles. Like that was the farthest thing from my mind. But
I think you need to do a little bit of shitting to get past something new. Because
to get past the kind of messianic instinct in these kind of retrospective accounts of very popular phenomena, right?
Yeah,
that like. Like, you know, nothing was good until the Beatles happened, and then suddenly, you know, all the girls liked music all of a sudden, you know, right? It's a question of, I mean, I think you've sort of expertly, like, laid out the dynamics, the internal dynamics, within the Beatles, within the band, within the song, and within the musical artifacts, you know, that they created, and that when that meets the social dynamics, when I, you know what I mean, when that is sort of set loose into a society with the size and economic power and kind of burgeoning qualities that America had at the time, it's a sort of multi-determined, you know, phenomenon, and the results are explosive.
Right. And then the feedback loops that you get once you're in, you know, 1964 and beyond, then there's all these micro cycles of these things, you know, feeding one another, and then, you know, even supporting, you know, the eventual, you know, dissolution of the Beatles and, you know, the kind of broader social change. I mean, these are all, it's very hard though, I think, and it's, I'm reluctant to move too much further beyond this, in part because it's beyond the scope of what we're listening to. And again, you run the risk of saying, yes, the Beatles caused the 60s and the 60s caused the Beatles. And, you know, this kind of just banal chicken egg type of description. But I think that there is, I guess it is, for that reason, is hard to talk about the Beatles, because that A, the big hits loom so big, and B, that they are so closely the close correlation with so many other things that are happening that's important, right? Sure. And so it's hard to really zoom in on the music. And again, our attempts to kind of go to the albums and go to the, you know, the deep cuts in addition to the singles is useful. I mean, did anything else strike you? What else
in the music? Yeah, sure. I mean, here's another thing, and maybe we can close on this, or on your reaction to it rather. It struck me that if you said, if you put a gun to my head and said you have to categorize these as either rock albums or pop albums, right? Do you think you would do with the Meet the Beatles and Hard Day's Night in the same category, or do you think that the sound of them is different enough that you would call one a rock album primarily and one a pop album primarily, or a pop rock or something like that, right? Like, because there's the indie and the pop, and then there's also the pop and the rock, right?
I mean, I think though, at this time, I think it's hard to actually separate the indie and the rock. And again, right, so that...
Yeah, I think indie isn't a term in this thing, right. But if you have, I mean, if you have...
So
like,
it's the rock, so I think that, you know, that, it, you know, retrospectively, you know, I'm wanting to say that With the Beatles is an indie pop album. What I really mean is that it's a rock album, right? A rock album that became... popular.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think it sounds a lot more like black music, frankly, than you know, I don't know what, It's My Party and I'll Cry If I Want To, or, you know, Teen Angel, or like, you know, any of the stuff. Oh, speaking of Teen Angel, 12-8, like 12-8, like triple time rock and triple time stuff. Another one of the kinds of groove, the kinds of various grooves that on Meet the Beatles that I was really impressed by. I was really impressed by the variety of it, never having listened to this particular album through before, and it still sticks with me. But I thought that A Hard Day's Night was maybe pulled back on sort of the wildness of rock and roll, maybe had a little less affinity with Chuck Berry, you know, and a little.
Yeah, I mean, you still have enough.
Sure. And it's electric guitars, and it's very loud, and they're, you know what I mean? Like, yes, absolutely. And I realize I'm sort of splitting hairs here, but.
No, I think that's exactly right. I think that's true. I mean, I think you know, in some ways, you have, it's definitely more restrained. It's like you have enough. right? It's like you have enough screams and shouts and woohoos not to alienate the base, right? that there's still enough, like, you know, you still rev the hormonal engine, you know, once every 3 to 4 songs, right? Whether that's, but do you find other ways to do that, right? That that there's, you know, in some ways, that they can still shout and yelp and gesticulate, but now they can also, like, write these super complex chords, right? That, you know, this Hard Day's Night, they you know, part of how they build the tension and release, you know, from the very beginning of the album is that first chord. It's written a lot about a lot. But the kind of open chord that opens the title track, that opens A Hard Day's Night. But I think throughout there's also a lot of other kinds of, you know, harmonic, some, you know, when the, depending on who enters and when, builds tension in the same ways, right? So that they use, you know, harmonic tools that, you know, are themselves much more of part of the toolkit of kind of the pop lexicon, but still then, you know, deploy them.
You mean,
almost
when you say that, you mean like Everly Brothers-esque close harmony singing of the main melody line, right?
Exactly. Yeah, yes, yeah. Exactly. But I think that what's really interesting is that what makes it still rock, but a more kind of almost subtle effusion of rock into pop, is right. So it's is rhythm, right? Is the rhythmic complexity, both at the level of, you know, particular, you know, particular attacks, right? Of when it hits, right? So sometimes, like, when that woo hits, like, it always gets you, right? That and it's a little more it's more refined than the
sure
or ow
sure. It's, but also there are also some legitimately, for the time, some legitimately adventurous rhythm stuff in, like, I'll Be Back with yeah, offbeat hits and stuff like that. That Ringo doesn't seem to be totally keeping up with.
That's true.
I don't mean to hate on Ringo, but is it not a fact that, like, someone was at, like, John was asked, is Ringo the best drummer in rock and roll? And he said, he's not even the best drummer in the Beatles. I mean, is it not
Jesus,
a fact?
Jesus is the best drummer in the Beatles.
Yeah. And I'll also, just to shit on my own point that I was trying to make, I think that sort of jangling, F, you know, F dominant 9 over D chord that begins the record, that, you know, it's a statement, you know what I mean? And it reminds me of, like, it reminds me of the screeching noise at the beginning of Depeche Mode's Song of Faith and Devotion. Mm-hmm. It's
the one that made you think that your CD player was broken.
Yeah,
right?
A famous one, a storied album in my own sort of personal narrative. It reminds me of the jangly sort of orientalist sound in Matangi, at the beginning of Matangi. Right, like, it's a sort of statement of, like, I'm here. It's a sort of state. It's a sort of manifesto. It's a sort of sonic manifesto of, you know, of uniqueness. Right, that, like, I'm here, and this is a sonic project that is, that's unlike what you've unlike what you've seen before, or that has very specific, that is a very specific sonic project that you know, I sort of don't care if you like, or, oh, you know what, here's another great one. It's not as jangling, but the way that Pet Sounds opens on Wouldn't It Be Nice, right, and then the key jumps down, you know, a major third from where you think it's going to start. It's very, you know, It's a move to disorient you and sort of make you feel as though you've entered kind of another sonic space. And that's
maybe we should do Beach Boys too, either sometime down the road.
Absolutely.
And so, yeah, I mean, I think maybe we will close it there. And so, you know, join in the conversation as always, listeners. You know, there's a few ways, but the modal ways of getting involved are either on Twitter at TFT Podcast or on the show notes on overthinkingit.com. And you know, we've kind of had an arc here, both traversing some of our own personal engagement with the Beatles, some of the context and history, and then some of our readings and you know, hearings of the songs themselves. So if you have anything to share on any of those, hit us up in all of those ways.
Before you sign off, I just want to apologize for some of the sound quality. We're doing the best we can in our hamstrung sometimes by what Skype is capable of. So, you know, we're the worst when you can't hear us. When you can hear us, we're the best.
Yes. Well, either way, we're both the Beatles of good sound quality and the Beatles of bad sound quality. And that, you know, I'm happy to say that there was something that was going on out in the population that was ready for this, and we were happy to just stride in and just stoke the flames of mania. So, as always, thank you for being there with us, and we will see you again next week on the next installment of the TFT Podcast.